We've got iNews, courtesy of MLive. The news organization reports there's a possibility Lansing could become home to Michigan's fifth Apple retail store. MLive says Apple's advertising job openings here, 13 jobs from store leaders to managers. The company's not officially announced a store, okay? It's apparently just the job openings that are being advertised. MLive reports that the website iPhone Apple Store says it could be the Eastwood Town Center. Eastwood officials were mum to MLive. It's current state here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. This winter has been brutal for all of us, but the extra snow, cold, and ice that we've been having this season has taken an especially rough toll on those who are living on low and fixed incomes. Our next guest says that the number of people requesting assistance with their utility bills is way up this year, and that the rise in need has been exacerbated by some recent measures enacted by the legislature. Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson is the director of the Human Relations and Community Service Department for the City of Lansing, and she's here to tell us more. We tried to connect the other day, and it just didn't work out over the phone. We're glad you came in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Sure.
It's been a busy season. It started in December with the change in the weather, and our shelters have been at overflow since that time, and the number of calls that we've received for utility assistance has just been unreal, you know, close to 50%. And these are individuals who are operating with fixed income.
Increase in calls is up 50%?
Absolutely.
That's what you're saying. Okay.
Yes. We document just to for transparency and to see, you know, what people are doing with the time, the kinds of calls that we're receiving, but for utility assistance only. And those, the second runner-up would be individuals seeking rental assistance. But the utility, I think, is probably the worst that I've seen since I've been in Michigan, and that's been a while. Part of it, obviously, is the weather, you know, related. You know, part of it is the longevity. You know, we had first the big snow of in December, and then the follow-up in January, that people haven't been able to regroup from that. Fuel and energy costs are up on top of that, which has just really compounded a really bad situation.
What sort of relief is available?
Well, generally, what we have is Department of Human Services. We have agencies that receive funding such as Capital Area Community Services, Salvation Army. We have the faith-based community that we rely on heavily, in particular organizations like St. Vincent de Paul. And the City of Lansing has a small grant that we give to one of the agencies to augment, you know, the unmet need, which ranges from $200 down. So, you know, with all of that out there, what we have now is a faith-based community referring people to the City of Lansing, which is generally the reverse of what we normally receive. Part of this started last year without my knowledge, and it slapped me in the face the end of September, and that was with Public Act 615.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Public Act 615 apparently in December of 2012 was passed by the legislators, signed into law January of 2013 by the governor. Our community and many communities that I've had contact with, including Department of Human Services locally, said that they did not become aware of this until near the end of September. The law, the program changes occurred October 1. Which basically delayed payment by 1 month for normal SER, which is state emergency relief services that citizens are entitled to depending on their income level. And without this advanced knowledge, we had people who assumed that the utilities that were off or those that were compromised, that they'd be eligible for this new money, which the max out at about $1,100 or $1,200 per household. With this delay, what happened is that people whose power was already off would not be eligible for that protective period, which begins in November. which means that if my utilities were off at my home, if I got them turned back on in October, I'd be safe from November 1 through March 31st.
Okay.
And with that delay in payment, many people were caught out in the cold. They were anticipating, you know, the services, and without knowledge from, you know, the higher powers and Department of Human Services, the community was just not prepared to respond in a timely fashion.
Ordinarily, how would officials like you learn about changes like PA 650?
Well, through the Department of Human Services or other state agencies who certainly would want to work with local government to make sure that citizens are protected when changes like that occur. We're talking about impacting the lives of children. We're talking about our seniors. We're talking about the medically fragile. Although with the medically fragile, the utility companies will not turn power off or any utilities off if you have advanced documentation.
Okay.
But that has to be in advance, you know, CPACs, breathing machines, oxygen, you know, things of that nature. The other catch-22 for people in the greater Lansing area is that the city of Lansing has an ordinance that says that if your house without any of the essential services, gas, water, light, your house will be tagged and you will be forced to leave or not stay there during essential hours until those utilities have been restored. We have a large percentage of individuals. Lansing Public Housing, for example, has under 1,000 units that people received at reduced rates for rent. Part of the lease with Section 8 and public housing is that if you have a lease with them or a rental agreement, that if you lose power, you are in violation of your lease and will be evicted from the program.
Hmm. What did I see? Public Act 615 also figures into this somehow.
Public Act 615 is a trigger point of the utility non-payment that normally would have occurred in October. And it is the trigger point now because those funds still aren't available to a vast number of our citizens, and they've depleted the resources that have been available through customary channels such as, you know, the churches, you know, CACS, Salvation Army, and the city.
Did someone somewhere drop the ball then in terms of communicating these changes to you?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Have you had any contact with the state over this?
We had a meeting with the Senate Appropriation for Department of Human Services. We've met with the state office, and people have held firm, you know, that these funds will be available on the back end of the year. Had they done it in reverse, allowed us to operate as usual, and then say these are the cuts and changes for coming up this year, 6 or 8 months would have given us a long time to prepare for this.
We're talking with Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson, who runs the Human Relations and Community Service Department for the City of Lansing. How much of a drop-off in funds, then, have these changes amounted to?
Well, it's hard to measure that now because very little have come out. Like, a person called our office the other day that had a huge bill, but it managed to get everything paid, and her water was off. And so what she said is that she said, contact DHS, blah, blah, blah. And the bottom line is they didn't consider that an emergency. I thought without water, although we have some citizens that have had to resort to using some of the ice and snow that Mother Nature has provided by melting that in their tubs to flush the toilets. I mean, that's not how we live in Lansing, and that's not how we treat our brothers and sisters. There has to be a different way to communicate and to make sure the most vulnerable and poor in our community are protected.
What are you telling people who contact the city for help?
Well, we are trying to help them navigate a system, but we're making lots of calls. We're asking them to call their legislators. We're asking them to call the State Office, Department of Human Services, and to continue to make contact with the local DHS, filling out the SERs, and we're trying to assist them in that process. We've had some churches from outside of the area that have heard some of these stories and are coming forth, but again, the resources outside of the state system are much more limited than what the state is holding on to at this point.
Can you adjust to this new normal?
Well, if I ever...
Sounds like everything changed here not too long ago,
right.
And we have a new normal.
Well, if I can recover from October 4th of this year. I mean, October, then there's November, and then December slams January. And so it's just keep mounting. And then the fuel costs have gone up on top of that. So it's almost a no-win situation for, you know, the poor and vulnerable of our community.
What other leaders in positions like yours have you communicated with? This is an issue across the state?
Yes, we have talked with some advocates out of Flint, out of Saginaw, looking at is there possibilities of a class action suit. I mean, this is a wrong approach. This has impact. I mean, when you look at what it's costing us, when DHS has had to remove some kids from unsafe environments because of the lack of utilities, and you result to foster care and all these changes, I mean, where are we paying more? We're paying more, you know, now than we would have had we delayed and given the community chance to prepare for these changes.
How do you feel about a class action suit?
Well, my boss, you know, wants to take a different approach in meeting again with DHS and some of the legislators. That's the mayor. And it certainly would take a longer time, obviously, class action. That's an emotional response on my part.
If people are in need of energy assistance in particular, what do you recommend?
Well, you know, I say start with the Department of Human Services and fill out a state emergency relief form. And if that doesn't go any place, to contact our office, I would say contact 211, but they've been just bombarded, and they don't know where to send people at this point. Capital Area Community Services did have a few weeks ago about $400,000 for the Greater Lansing area, which included Shiawassee County, and that's not a lot.
Has the propane situation, the propane shortage, impacted your office?
Well, the shortage hasn't hit our office as much, although we've gotten a few calls from the Elk County area. What has hit our office is the price. In some cases, people have skyrocketed, you know, like 200% on propane fuel. I mean, it's just unreal. Mm-hmm. And so you compound that with what's happening out there already, the limited income, our working poor. I mean, people are really getting hit hard.
We're led to believe propane is more used in rural areas, though. Does it play a bigger role in the city of Lansing than we might think?
I would say not as big as the other utilities, but we do get calls, and people are calling out of desperation. You know, they don't know where else to turn. So we don't get as many of the propane calls. Those that we do, we refer automatically to Capital Area Community Services because they handle the rural area.
Okay. Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson is the director of the Human Relations and Community Service Department for the City of Lansing. Joan, thanks for joining us today. And current state production assistant Hannah Michael John went out on the street to ask folks in the Lansing area how they've been coping with the higher utility bills this winter. Here's some of what she heard.
We've just been generally trying to cut back because my husband's very underemployed right now, so the utilities don't help with that, and there's been a lot of snow and cold. But yes, we're trying to cut back a little to make things right, and you know, setting the furnace back to like 58 at night, that sort of thing.
I've moved tenants into my house. I got a couple rooms I rent to college students to try and offset the winter time. I put plastic on the windows, under the doors. I put film, you know, keep the breeze from coming in. Insulate the attic better, keep the heat turned down to like 66.
You know, you kind of expect your bills to go up a little bit. You know, I think we need to probably have a talk with our landlord about, you know, fixing up some areas of our house, because I think just the fact that our house is drafty is kind of, you know, a big part of the reason why our bills have gone up. But, you know, it's money that comes out of, you know, groceries and student loan payments and things like that. So the bills have just gotten a little bit, you know, tighter, and not as much money left over at the end of each paycheck, you know, as you normally have.
Oh, it's been breaking my pockets. Me and my fiance, we've been going really broke trying to make ends meet so we can take care of that, because we got to have utilities on, you know. I had to pick up side jobs and things like that to take care of it just for this winter. Like, usually my utility bills is about $80 would be high. I just got one that's like $200, so that's a big jump for me, a real big jump.
That was Jody Lewis, Patrick Barnes, Sam Englott, and Reno Patterson on coping with this winter's higher utility bills. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Comic lovers from across the state will converge in East Lansing this week for the annual MSU Comics Forum. This year's event features an artist alleyway, panel discussions, and keynote speaker Stan Sakai. Here to tell us more is Ryan Claytor, director of the Michigan State University Comics Forum. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I'm well. It's a pleasure to have you. And Brandon Hankins is an MSU student who is part of this year's Artist Alley. Brandon, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Ryan, when many people hear comics, especially a comic gathering, they think of a comics convention. What is a comics forum?
Well, it's kind of a hybrid, at least ours is anyway, between a comic convention where fans meet creators and a comics academic summit where there's scholarly discussions about comics. So we try to blend the two of them. Basically, we've got an artist alley running concurrently with a bunch of scholarly panel discussions throughout the day this coming Saturday, and they're within feet from one another. So scholars can mingle with the artists and artists with the scholars and fans with everybody. So we try to make it kind of a unique event in that way.
But the comics convention is typically not quite so scholarly.
Traditionally.
That's the difference, right?
Traditionally,
there.
That's true.
What do you gain by bringing all of these different facets of the comics world together?
Well, I think we can only benefit from having knowledge of one another. You know, if the scholars, were just isolated and weren't talking to creators or fans or vice versa, I think it would be a much more narrow view on the medium. But I think bringing them all together kind of expands our view of the medium.
Brandon, there's a perception that comics consist of men in tights. How does the medium go beyond that?
Well, I mean, comics, like people think of comics as a genre, and they tend to associate that with superheroes and Marvel and DC and wearing tights. Comics is actually a medium of art, and like most mediums of art, you can have different genres and different ideas, you know, perpetuated within that medium. Like you can have, you know, science fiction, you can have fantasy, you can have romance. It's not really confined by, you know, the movies or, you know, like Batman and Superman and stuff like that.
Okay. What? Give us an example of a really new, outside the boundaries approach to comics that doesn't involve superheroes.
I do one better. I do one that's been running for 30 years. Stan Sakai's own Usagi Yojimbo, as a matter of fact. One of the longest running independent books is about a samurai rabbit, essentially. And it's inspired by a real-life swordsman called Miyamoto Musashi, and that is one of the most beautiful books I've ever read in my life. And it's about a samurai rabbit.
Okay. A samurai rabbit.
Yes.
Ryan, as an artist, how would you say your work varies from the mainstream?
Well, my work is mainly focused on autobiography, so there's stories about my life, and they've kind of shifted throughout the years. When I first started doing them, they were more autobiographical strips, so they were like done in one page. But they've moved to more longer length storylines and started focusing on autobiographical theory and how that relates to the comics medium.
Autobiographical theory. And where do you present your work? Is this an online phenomenon?
It's printed in books, and you can pick it up in many places, comic book stores, conventions, my website, but it's to have and to hold. I initially publish on my website, but then publish in print.
Okay. You're kind of going against the mainstream there in a way. You're resisting the trend toward digitizing and going online. You're saying that the comic experience is really about a tactile thing, holding a comic book or some printed material in your hands.
I think it's different for everybody, and I don't think there's one right answer for that. I mean, all the mainstream publishers are kind of scrambling and trying to figure out what it is they need to do, if they're staying in print, if they're moving to digital, if they're doing both. And it kind of seems like the latter is what's happening, is doing both. You know, people want the convenience of having 50 books on their tablet, but then they also want the collectability of having a tangible item to have and to hold. And I was actually really surprised. Not a year ago, I polled my comics class here at MSU, and I said, you know, are you guys mainly readers of ebooks, or do you pick up physical comic books to get your comics?
Uh-huh.
And across the board, they said, we still buy physical comics. And I thought that, you know, the younger generation would be the ones to spearhead this e-movement.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly what triggered my question. Yeah.
And I think it's really more a fact of, you know, we are so bombarded with electronic devices, computers, e-readers, phones, you name it, that, you know, there's kind of a movement back toward tactile, you know, things that you can hold in your hand. I mean, you see that with the boom of Etsy.
Vinyl
and
records.
There you go.
Pops into my head as well.
Yeah.
We're talking with Ryan Claytor, director of the Michigan State University Comics Forum, and Brandon Hankins, an MSU senior and comic artist. We're talking about this weekend's MSU Comics Forum. Brandon, as a student and as an aspiring comic book artist, what's it been like for you to attend conventions over the years?
It's been a pretty enlightening experience, especially with the Comics Forum. I've been to a few conventions before the forum. I would go to the Motor City Comic Con mostly, and you know, it's very big and very up to scale and very loud. And I like the Comics Forum because it gives you more like of an interaction between like yourself and the other creators, and it being smaller and a bit quieter. It gives you like more time to think and ask the right questions and, you know, process the information and just to network, you know.
But you feel East Lansing's a good place to host an event like this?
Yeah, I would say so. Okay. I mean, MSU has the second largest comics library. Like
the largest.
Oh, the largest. All right.
We're number one. What for the show, you'll be displaying your work in this artist alley. What's it like to go from attendee to actually being showcased?
It is really exciting. I mean, I've taken Ryan's comics class before, and I've sold that comic a few times at different venues. But this is like the first independent work that I've like started and finished, you know, on my own since then, and it's pretty exciting. Like I get to see everybody who used to look up to and aspire to, you know, be like,
yeah.
And I get to sit like next to them as opposed to across the table.
Rub shoulders with these folks.
Yeah.
We should point out that Ryan's got his young child here with him. So if you hear a sound that what appears to be a very young person, he's cooperating very, very well. Oh, I'm getting the hairy eyeball there for just a little bit. Ryan, we mentioned the Artist Alley. Tell us about some of the other features at this year's event, and tell us about Stan Sakai.
Okay, well, I'll tell you about Stan Sakai first. He is an industry veteran that's been working for over 30 years. You know, he has decades of experience, and he has this really thoughtful book that Brandon told you about. You know, basically, he researches 17th century feudal Japan, and he happens to portray those stories in an anthropomorphic world. And we're really lucky to have him this year. He's been, you know, really undergoing some tough times with his family recently. His wife has had a debilitating illness, and on top of that, his grandson passed away 2 months ago. So we're just really thankful to have him with us. He's not making many convention appearances, so if anybody's able to get out here and support us and support Stan, we'd really appreciate it. Bouncing over to the events for the Comics Forum, this is actually the biggest year we've ever put on the forum. We have the most number of artists. We have the most number of events we've ever had. We've started off at the beginning of the week with a gallery exhibition of Asian comics, and that is from the MSU Library Special Collections, which is the largest public collection of comics in the entire world. So there's other libraries that house more original artwork or more of this, that, or the other thing. But as far as comic books are concerned, we have the largest collection in the world in our own backyard. So this is an exhibition from the Special Collections Library here. Tonight we've got a documentary film screening. Naji Al-Ali, an artist with vision. And all of these events that I'm mentioning are on the Comics Forum website if you want some more information. It's comicsforum.msu.edu. Tomorrow night, we've got an in-store signing with Nate Powell, who's a New York Times best-selling author and artist. He's been making the circuit around all of the major news networks with his most recent book that he illustrated, March. And tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, we've got the, you know, spearhead of the entire event, which is the keynote address with Stan Sakai. Following that up on Saturday, we've got the Artist Alley and panel discussions running throughout the day from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Most of these events are on the campus of MSU, and like I said, more information is available at comicsforum.msu.edu.
Brandon, when was your first MSU Comics Forum? This is the seventh one. Which one was your first?
I got here 2009, so I guess the 2010 Comics Forum was my first Comics Forum.
2010. How has it grown just in the last couple of years?
Well, like Ryan said, it's like just grown bigger from year to year, and you know, it's different artists and like a different flavor pretty much every year, and that's kind of something I've come to anticipate and kind of enjoy. Like some years you would have, you know, a few guys from Marvel come in and talk, like Ryan Stegman, who does Superior Spider-Man, was here 2 years ago and also last year. And this year it seems like a bit more focused on independent work, which I enjoy. So I'm looking forward to that.
I want to ask both of you a question. Do you wish there were greater awareness of the comics world among the mainstream, or do you prefer that you're inhabit this own little kind of universe that you do? Brandon?
Okay. How I feel about this is I don't necessarily think that the mainstream needs to, you know, know about comics like as a big huge thing, but I do think that there needs to be more of an understanding and respect of the medium, you know, as an art form and as, you know, not just this, you know, child's pastime. Like grown adults like make and read comics, and it's not just for kids. It's not just, you know, like elementary school stuff. Like these are serious stories, and it's a serious work being done.
What about you, Ryan? Do you like being perceived as alternative, or does that irritate you?
I really don't mind the alternative perception. I hope that more people, as Brandon said, get to understand that the medium is far more diverse than they might think. You know, I mentioned this to my students on the first day of class, that, you know, people kind of have this perception of comics as superheroes or comics as funny animals, when really, you know, that would be akin to walking in a bookstore and making the claim that all of these books are cookbooks. I mean, it's just an absurd statement. Hmm. And, you know, every genre that exists in books exists in comics. So whatever you're interested in, it's been made in comics. Sci-fi, romance, humor, horror, autobiography, fiction, nonfiction, historical fiction, anything you can name has been done in comics. So really, that's the perception that I would like people to know about.
Ryan Claytor is the director of the Michigan State University Comics Forum. We've also been talking with Brandon Hankins, an MSU senior and comic artist, about this week's MSU Comics Forum. Have fun, guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Despite all those studies that show America's education system is lagging further behind in the world, it turns out all is not lost when it comes to our collective knowledge about science and technology. A portion of a big national survey released late last week measured the public perceptions of science and technology and compared the data to similar studies around the world. The results show that while Americans, like much of the rest of the world, still have some basic things to learn, there is a keen interest in the latest scientific and technological discoveries. The survey was part of the National Science Foundation's report on science and engineering indicators that it puts out every other year. John Besley was the lead author of the report's chapter on public attitudes and understanding. John's an associate professor here at MSU and the Ellis Brandt Chair in Public Relations in the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences. And John joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Your chapter is stuffed with all kinds of stats from a lot of different studies. As the lead writer who had to ride herd on all of this and make sense of it all, what are your biggest takeaways?
So I would love to say there were, actually I'm happy to say there aren't any big changes, which is nice. This is meant to be an indicators report, so we're tracking things over time. And so to me, the most interesting thing is how steady science has been. You know, there's lots of political debates out there about various specific scientific issues, but to me, interest for science, staying pretty stable. People's knowledge about science, staying pretty stable. People's confidence in scientists, which I think is super key, is staying pretty stable.
Hmm. What methodology was used to put this together?
So the main component of it is a giant survey that the University of Chicago does, which is part of it's called the General Social Survey, and it's really one of our best surveys in the world. In this case, more than 2,000 people, face-to-face surveys, response rate of 71%. It's an amazing, giant survey that's just super high quality. And then we bring in, once we have that data, and NSF has a specific science section that's built into that. And once we have that data, we try to find other surveys that have been done around the world in the last few years that can sort of speak to that data, and we can put that into conversation with.
But your chapter focused on U.S. attitudes?
So it's primarily, it focuses on U.S. attitudes, but for each sort of subsection, there's a international comparison section.
Okay. So where from around the world do we learn about attitudes toward science as well?
Yeah, so the European Union does relatively regular surveys. I wish they was a little more regular, but the European Union does them. In this case, there were surveys out of Japan, Korea. China has a gigantic science survey. It's a few years old now, but still just an amazing, giant survey. Where else do we have them?
South America?
Not a lot from South America. Brazil has done one in a few years, but I don't think we had any recent data from Brazil. I think that's probably the main ones. We don't have good stuff from the Middle East. We don't have good stuff from Africa, unfortunately. I'd love to see that data. There is a survey coming out soon from other university, other Michigan, that will have hopefully some of that data.
Tell us more about how we fare with regard to other countries.
Yeah, I think so. We do pretty well, I think. I mean, the U.S., I think, has a, you know, as much as any other country has a culture of science. And so I think our interest levels are pretty similar. You know, you look at the best data is there's a survey that was done a couple of years ago in sort of the five largest European countries as well as five more European countries. And what you see there is there's always a couple countries, Denmark, say, that on any given question does a little better than the U.S. But the U.S. is always right there, whether it's interest, whether it's knowledge, whether it's perceived promise of science or reservations with science. The U.S. is you know, we have a pretty high regard for science and scientists.
And then, I mean, you alluded to this earlier, but popular attitudes toward scientists and engineers, is it generally respectful? Is it doubtful? How does that break out?
I think, so one, people want their kids to go into science. People, I mean, whether it's a son or a daughter, which is nice, it's no difference. People, 80, 90% of people want their kid to go, would be happy if their kid went into science. Mm. So that's great. I mean, that's right off the front. And then you ask some specific questions. People think scientists, I mean, overwhelming majority think scientists are trying to do good for humanity, do good things for the world. So that's great too. You know, you get into some weird ones, some fun questions that sort of speak to, I don't know, popular images of scientists. So maybe a third of people think that scientists are odd and peculiar. Which, you know, I'm guessing
that was the actual phrase, odd and peculiar.
I think that is the actual phrase, yeah.
Oh, my.
What is it? Odd and peculiar people. Scientists are apt to be odd and peculiar people. And so, but I think that's safe to say that about a third of people are odd and peculiar people in every field. So
you don't have to be a scientist to be considered odd and peculiar. Now, 50%, I see, agree or strongly agree that science is dangerous.
Yeah, that one.
What do you take that to mean?
That's the one I would love to better understand, and I'm sort of starting to play with the background data. But I don't know. Memories from science class. I don't know what that might be.
Well, science grapples. What comes to mind for me is science grapples with a lot of alarming situations. I think of communicable diseases.
Sure.
and climate change and things that affect the whole planet. I'm wondering if they're really that's really more of a reflection of the scale of the problems, potential problems that we face, rather than the danger that science is in and of itself.
Right. It may be that they're answering the scientists work with issues that are dangerous rather than that scientists themselves are in danger. It's an interesting question. I'd love to find a way to we'll find out a little more what happened there.
So support for scientific research is there, but funding for research has been cut considerably in the last few years. How does the scientific community translate attitudes into more financial support?
I mean, I think this is sort of a perennial question. So clearly people think the government, 80% think that government should be funding basic science. Now when you ask, is science getting too little, the right amount, or getting too much, you know, then you don't see science. Most people think it's either too little or too much. There's not many, or sorry, just the right amount. But there's other issues that people would like to see funded even more. And so, you know, I think that's the perennial question. And one thing we know from this, I think often scientists think that if we just teach people more about science, they'll want to fund more about science. But I think it's actually the bigger question is how do people feel about science and see science as being relevant and important? And so
if the funding scenario for science stays relatively limited or continues to be cut back, what would you anticipate, say, in a couple of years? Would you expect that to register in the results of a survey like this?
So you do see that the number of people saying that funding for science is too little, that there's too little funding for science. That's been sort of creeping up. And so I think that could be it's hard to know exactly what's going on there, but maybe that's a reflection of people seeing that disinvestment and reacting to it. And, yeah, I mean, I think that's one of those things that those of us who are interested in the area will be watching to see if people.
How much does the way the media treats science, how much does that weigh into some of these findings that we're talking about?
So there's specific questions about where people get their news.
Yeah,
so
where is that? So I mean, mostly, is that part of the report?
There is. So that front section is really about where people get news about science, news in general, but then also news about science. And so that's sort of the pattern you would expect, where television's pretty strong, so the main one, but it's sort of declining. Newspapers is declining. Well, internet goes up. Now, this time around, they asked what do people mean by internet? And really what they mean is online newspapers and that kind of thing. So TV and newspapers are about the same level. But if you ask people if you wanted to know something about science, where would you get it? They say, overwhelmingly, I'd go online and search it out. And so one of the things that, you know, the science community is working on is making sure that there's lots of great science resources online and good quality science resources, science things that are clearly credible, that when people do go online, that's what they come to. That's what they find.
How might we improve numbers where arguably it's a good thing to have higher numbers here, greater understanding, greater support, that kind of thing?
Yeah, and so a lot of my day-to-day research involves science communication and public engagement with science. And if you see, you know, MSU in April is going to have a science festival where people are going to be invited on campus, and it's sort of meant to be a celebration of science. It's going to be, you know, there's things in the evening for adults. There's stuff for kids, stuff for adults. And I think that's sort of indicative of the wider scientific community, which is trying to find ways to bring people into closer contact, to make sure that people know scientists, that scientists are their neighbor. And in a community like East Lansing, I mean, scientists are your neighbors. And so getting to know and understand that science is part of you know, our culture, both locally, but more broadly in almost every community.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with John Besley. John was the lead author of a chapter on scientific public attitudes and understanding, part of a National Science Foundation report that's conducted every other year. What happens in a study like this, John, when politics creeps into science? Climate change has become incredibly politicized over the years. Does that show up in a survey like this?
So this is tricky because this is written by the National. I write it, but I'm really writing it on behalf of the National Science Board. I'm talking on behalf of myself, but the report itself is written for the National Science Board. And so they're very careful not to have. There's no breakdown here by demographics, by religion. And which is kind of, it's a funny thing because, you know, when you get into the last section of the report, which is attitudes about specific issues, you get to climate change, you get to genetically modified foods. And so, yeah, it's very assiduously doesn't get into some of the tricky things. Now, does it appear, does it, I mean, we pick the issues that are picked about to talk about in terms of public attitudes, those are the ones that are in public debate.
Mm-hmm.
I was at this conference over the weekend where we were, American Association for the Advancement of Science, where we talk about a lot of these things. And there were some people there who were talking about, you know, this really, this fear that some of these issues are becoming politicized, and we just don't know how to unpoliticize them. We don't know how to make them into science issues again.
Yeah. I have to ask finally, what's going on with astrology? The data shows Americans are becoming less skeptical of astrology.
Yeah, that's a funny one. So, and there's been some neat sort of online debate about what that question really means. One of the perennial questions is, are people mixing up astrology and astronomy? And so it may be that, and are they doing it more often now?
Okay.
Because maybe people read horoscopes less, I don't know. And so that might be one of what's going on there. It's, again, that's one of those ones where there's sort of this remarkable drop this last round. And I think we'll be paying close attention to see if that's a continued thing. And then also figuring out, when you see that, like, well, all right, now we got to figure out why.
Uh-huh. John Besley was the lead author of the chapter on public attitudes and understanding in the latest National Science Foundation report on science and engineering indicators. John's an associate professor at MSU and the Ellis Brandt Chair in Public Relations in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences. Thanks for joining us, John.
Thank you so much.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, enjoying the Devo here on the program today. This Saturday night, the MSU Wind Symphony's much-anticipated Carnegie Hall concert brings music of Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Corigliano to the stage. Professor Kevin Setitol leads the ensemble in a 10th anniversary performance of Corigliano's Circus Maximus, and WKAR's Peter Worf is here to tell us more.
Mark, you know that West 57th Street is the ultimate destination for so many classical musicians.
Yes.
That's where Carnegie Hall resides. The MSU Wind Symphony will take John Corigliano's Circus Maximus to the stage this Saturday night at 8 o'clock. It's an epic work. It's much more than a wind symphony piece. It's theater. It's drama. It's so much, and if you got the chance to hear it a couple of weeks ago at the Wharton Center, you know what I'm talking about. Remember, we previewed that piece, Mark, couple of weeks ago and listened to a bit of it. Then I went to see Wind Symphony conductor Kevin Setitol a few days ago, who talked about the piece and the electricity at the College of Music about this New York trip.
Everybody is really excited, and as soon as we saw, someone sent me a picture from New York, a friend of mine. He said, I'm not sure you've seen this, but it was a picture of our Playbill poster up in their glass cases. And so I wrote him back immediately. He's like, no, I haven't seen this. That's pretty, it's very cool and a little overwhelming that it's there now. And and that just moves as the days move. It gets closer to the front door. So we're right next to Philadelphia Orchestra. They play the night before us. People are getting excited for sure.
What have some of the students commented about?
I just took a hand count last week in rehearsal. I'm like, how many of you guys have never been to New York before? And probably at least 20 hands went up. So I'm like, well, you're getting ready to get blown away as soon as we pull into the city. And we're going in at night. So when we pull up next to Carnegie, you can see all the way down to Times Square. And it's I remember the first time I was there, I was just overwhelmed. I was just like, oh, my gosh, you know.
Talk about much earlier on the road to the Wind Symphony, Corigliano, and Carnegie Hall. You had a performance of this piece at the Wharton Center, not just recently, last week, but several years ago.
Yeah, 4 years ago, actually. That's when this whole thing kind of was born. So we had Mr. Corigliano here for a residency, and then that residency ended with a kind of big troika concert with the Wind Symphony, the Symphony Orchestra, and the Chorale. And so that evening, I remember asking him, knowing that the 10th anniversary was 4 years away, that I'd like to set a goal to come to Carnegie Hall and do this. And he absolutely agreed. He loved our performance here.
This takes the MSU College of Music to another level.
That was the goal. I mean, Carnegie is definitely one of those places that has set help set the musical standard for the entire country, if not the world. When you think about what's happened there historically, I think I said on an interview last week that, you know, it's changed the fabric of American music, the things that have happened on that stage.
A musical world stage with the subtext of the Circus Maximus in Rome and sort of mass media excess, the sorts of things that Corigliano himself has described in his thoughts about the work. Can you give us sort of the tour of this piece as a work for wind symphony and as theater, because there's so many of these elements?
Sure. Well, it is a reflection of the Roman Circus Maximus, but it's now put into modern day times. It's about the society really being saturated by technology and everything that's around us, just like the Romans were 1,000 years ago in the real Circus Maximus. The piece takes us through a journey from this fanfare announcement of 11 trumpets around the hall and percussion, and there's an exchange that goes on, and finally it reaches the ensemble on stage, and then there's this kind of mass theme that comes back regularly throughout the piece. It's just shrieking, it's announcing, it's quirky. It's a lot of different elements that we see every day in life. Then all of a sudden, in the second movement, it changes to this absolutely serene, subtle, almost melancholy music that's played by the saxophone quartet and string bass, but they are not on stage. They're way, way up in the highest balcony in Carnegie Hall, to where you can barely hear them. And so the music just soothes you into this, almost a dreamlike state. And then different instruments around the hall start joining in. And as soon as the audience is lulled, then we kick right into this movement called channel surfing, which is supposed to be literally like somebody watching TV. You can hear the click sound. I mean, John's taking us back to the old days where you really did have a clicker and it made a noise. Nowadays, we don't have that. But in fact, the students didn't even know what that was. All of this kind of builds up again, and he finally takes us back into the Circus Maximus, and we have a collection of everything we've heard up to this point. It all mixes together, and he takes us to what he calls the loudest sound that he's ever written, and it is quite loud. It's loud for a long time, then a very, very long decrescendo. And then that moves us into the prayer. And the prayer is John's way of comforting the audience. It's absolutely gorgeous music. It's very powerful music. At the end of the prayer, he takes us into the coda, or veritas, the truth, and it takes us right back to the beginning of the piece, really. And then we give the final cutoff, and that's ended with the shotgun blast. You know, the piece itself is monumental, as I said to the audience last week, but maybe more important, it's influenced so many other composers at this point that someone like John Corigliano is writing for wins. And so he's convinced his colleagues and contemporaries that this is a very viable ensemble, and the kind of performances you get, it's worth it as a composer.
Kevin, have you thought about what you'll say to your musicians when you first take the stage?
You know, I'm not sure I have to say anything. It just, the play speaks for itself. And I think once they hear the first sound, there's a lot of pent-up emotion that goes with this. It's not bad emotion by any means. It's all great. And I remember I was with another group, another university, that we were ending a big tour at Carnegie Hall, and it was the same effect. We weren't performing music of the magnitude of this, but I remember the students like having a very visceral reaction because it's, you know, for a musician, that is a big deal, particularly if you've never been to New York City before.
Kevin Sonnatall is professor of music at Michigan State University. He'll lead the MSU Wind Symphony in music of John Corigliano, Saturday night. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
We always appreciate the feedback we get from you, supportive or critical. A few of you wrote to us taking issue with last week's segment with economist Richard Vedder, who spoke about a higher education bubble in the United States.
We simply have too many people going to college and getting degrees for the kinds of jobs that are available that the college students traditionally expected to get. So the jobs that college kids are getting, graduates are getting after they finish, in some cases are far less well-paying, involve less skills and so forth than what they expected.
Several of you pointed out a news story that broke shortly after the interview, a new study from the Pew Research Center indicating a growing income advantage that college graduates enjoy compared to high school graduates. One listener also pointed out that Dr. Vedder's organization, the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, is, in fact, not associated with Ohio University. As we said, he is, however, on the school's economics faculty. We regret mishandling that. Also, Bob Francoeur of East Lansing wrote in after last week's segment on the apparent rise in hearing problems among the young. Bob writes, "The growing noise factor in our lives is too easily dismissed as an unavoidable part of progress. The brains of young people are programmed through constant exposure to expect and embrace it. We tolerate noisy traffic, noisy machines, and loud audio as if there was nothing to be done about it. There may be hundreds of ways noise could be reduced." Thanks, Bob. That is Current State for today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll discuss changes to the Holt School District that are generating controversy. We'll hear from guests on each side of the issue, including Superintendent Johnny Scott. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Aaron Young is our engineer. Also thanks to Hannah Michael John for production assistance. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.